Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by, and welcome to the Covington Tech Briefing Conference. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Please note today's call is being recorded. If you require any further assistance, please press star zero. I would now like to hand the conference over to your presenters for today. Thank you. Please go ahead, presenters.
Thank you. This is Dan Luesinger. Welcome to a webinar on Key Considerations and Opportunities, Cash and Liquidity Impacts of the TCJA on Losses. A couple overarching issues before we get started. First, we're not going to be showing a slide deck during the presentation, but one is included in your invitation, so please feel free to follow along. Additionally, email questions to amcmanus@cov.com. The address should also be in the invitation. Please email the questions throughout the presentation. We'll triage as best we can, and then we'll also have time at the end and even go over the hour if there's interesting questions remaining. And then finally, given the logistics involved at this point, you'll hear from each of the four speakers serially. We won't be interrupting one another. Again, my name is Dan Luesinger. It is my great honor and pleasure to be chair of the tax group at Covington, and also to introduce this panel of speakers. Lindsay Kitzinger is a partner in the tax group who practices, whose practice focuses on international tax planning. She rejoined the firm recently after serving more than 3 years in the Office of International Tax Counsel at Treasury, where she worked extensively on guidance on the international provisions of the TCJA. Mike Nanaka is co-chair of the Financial Services Group and advises banks, financial services providers, and non-bank companies on a broad range of compliance, enforcement, transactional, and legislative matters. He has worked extensively with federal and state banking agencies and with other federal agencies authorized to regulate financial services. Ed McClellan is a partner in our tax and public policy practices. He was formerly tax counsel to the Senate Finance Committee under Chairman Grassley, and as you may imagine, he has been going 24/7 full out for the last 10 days. Michael Caballero is a partner in the tax group who practices in international tax. Michael joined us from the U.S. Treasury, where he was international tax counsel at U.S. Treasury's Office of Tax Policy. This webinar grew out of observations many of us have been making in our tax and banking practices over the past little bit. Impacts of the TCJA on companies and banks, cash and liquidity, those issues have been discussed now everywhere, from the Wall Street Journal to the daily tax and banking news sheets. In fact, there was a couple articles this morning in Bloomberg. Many of the issues are obvious, for example, the impacts on NOL carrybacks, but many of the issues are more nuanced, for example, the overlay of losses on BEAT or GILTI. We won't raise all of the issues or try to explore each in detail. Instead, we will spend the next hour identifying some of the main TCJA impacts on cash taxes and banking, capital and liquidity. We'll discuss recent legislative proposals and which impacts might be addressed. And finally, we'll discuss some block and tackle tax planning that companies ought to be thinking about as we approach mid-year. So without further ado, let me turn it over to Lindsay.
Hi. So I'm going to go through at a very high level some of the changes that were made by TCJA that can have a more significant impact when a company is in a loss position. So we'll start with the first, most obvious, which Dan just mentioned. The TCJA made significant changes to the net operating loss rules. Before TCJA, a loss could be carried back 2 years, carried forward 20 years, and there were no limits on the amount of taxable income a loss could offset in the year to which it was carried. But now, post-TCJA, there are no loss carrybacks. The loss can be carried forward to an unlimited amount of years, but when you carry it forward, you can only use it to offset up to 80% of the taxable income in that year. So post-TCJA, the NOL is preserved for a longer time, but it's harder to use in the sense that you have to wait. You can't carry it back to get the cash back more immediately, and you have to wait to incur tax in a future year to be able to use it. And when you use it, you can't offset all of the loss. You still have to incur tax in that year. TCJA also introduced the interest limitation under Section 163J, which limits the company's ability to deduct interest expense. In general, the way the rules work is that the company is limited to 30% of EBITDA, which means that where borrowing increases or earnings fall, the limit will bite more. And both of these conditions are more likely in times of economic upheaval or when the company is losing money. As with NOLs, the deduction for the expense isn't lost, carried forward, but then again, to use that benefit, the deduction, you have to incur, you have to have income and capacity under 163J to take advantage of it. Who a company borrows from can also have other impacts under the TCJA, in particular on BEAT. BEAT, which most people are familiar with at this point, eliminates deductions for certain related party payments. And what it effectively does is that since it operates as a minimum tax, it uses a base other than taxable income, which means you can have BEAT liability even where the company is overall losing money. And the way this works, and if you look at the slides, there's sort of a very simplified example, but if the loss in taxable income is less than the amount of base erosion tax benefit that the BEAT adds back, then you will have BEAT liability even though the company is in a loss position. And the impact of BEAT is not limited to the year in which the loss occurs, because if the 172 deduction, the NOL deduction that rolls forward is made up in part of these related foreign related party deductions that the BEAT adds back, then in future years when you use the NOL deduction, that can also give rise to BEAT liability under the rules. One of the more significant changes in TCJA were the rules around the taxation of income from foreign markets. So U.S. person either earns foreign income through a CFC or through its domestic entity. That income is now subject to a lower rate of tax either through GILTI or FDII, which is great in some cases, but also has weird outcomes in some cases where you have losses. So, for example, if you have a loss in a single CFC, that can eliminate certain tax attributes for purposes of calculating your GILTI. So you can lose your QBI and tested foreign income taxes, and that can increase your overall liability for tax under GILTI. If you have an overall loss in your foreign operations, that loss can't be carried forward, and any associated tested foreign taxes are also not carried forward. So you can use what you can use to offset the income in the year, but if you have excess losses, it's not like a domestic loss that can get carried forward and used against income in future years. If you have losses by the domestic subsidiary, because the rate adjustment on GILTI and FDI is achieved through a deduction that is limited to taxable income, that is subject to a limit based on taxable income, if you have losses in your domestic entity, it can lower the amount of that deduction and thus effectively raise the rate on GILTI and FDII. You might not have to pay GILTI or FDII tax on FDII in the year because you have overall losses, but you're using a loss that could otherwise offset 21% income against income that is typically taxed at a 10.5% or a 13.125% rate. And if you have a loss in the U.S., that can also lower your Section 904 limitation, which means you would lose any deemed paid credits in the GILTI basket. And unlike other baskets, those credits can't be carried forward to a future year. And then the last subject I'm going to just touch on is tax repatriation. TCJA was intended to move us towards a territorial system with a dividends received deduction. The issue is that most of the earnings offshore now are not really earnings that are eligible for the 245 Cap 8 deduction. They're more likely to be PTEP because of the operation of the transition tax under Section 965 and because of GILTI. In theory, PTEP, the difference between PTEP and 245 Cap 8 shouldn't be that big of a deal because PTEP is supposed to be distributable to the U.S. on a tax-free basis. But in reality, distributions of PTAP are subject to very complicated sets of rules for which there is little final guidance. There is, 10 different types of PTAP. Each of those PTAP have a different tax rate, different foreign tax and foreign currency consequences. If there is insufficient basis in the chain in which the PTAP is being distributed, there's a chance you could recognize gain under Section 961B, which would be at 21%. And so all of these create an environment where there's a lot of considerations that have to go into making a distribution of cash back to the U.S., even though TCJ was intended to facilitate those kinds of distributions. And then sort of paradoxically at the same time, the rules now for making loans back to the U.S. are somewhat lessened because Treasury has issued regulations that turn off the application of 956 when the earnings, if distributed, would otherwise qualify for the dividends received deduction. And you know, historically, always, you've been able to make a loan back to the U.S. when you have PTAP in the amount of the loan. And so we're in a situation now where even though TCJA was intended to facilitate distributions, the effect might have actually been to facilitate more loans back to the U.S. And so that was a very quick overview of sort of the big changes by TCJA. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Mike Nanaka, who is going to discuss the impacts of TCJA on the bank regulatory capital rules.
Great. Thanks, Lindsay. We thought we would close this section of the presentation, and this is the 10th slide if you're following along, by discussing just a few of the effects of the TCJA on regulatory capital requirements that apply to U.S. banks and also foreign banking organizations doing business in the U.S. So for a bank that's subject to these requirements, the TCJA will have two negative effects on regulatory capital when the organization has an unprofitable year compared to the prior version of the tax code. So first, TCJA, as Lindsay said, eliminated NOL carrybacks, and NOL carrybacks have what we call a countercyclical effect on regulatory capital in an unprofitable year that follows profitable years. So NOL carrybacks are treated as deferred tax assets that are not deducted from regulatory capital, and they have a countercyclical effect insofar as they produce tax refund income, which increases regulatory capital in unprofitable years that follow profitable ones. And as a result, TCJA may have a negative impact on regulatory capital in the year that we're in today and with everything going on. And so for similar reasons, TCJA will also have larger peak-to-trough declines in capital ratios and stress testing for banking organizations that were profitable in years leading up to the current one. The TCJA also has a watered-down pro-cyclical effect of the prior compared to the prior tax code that had the effect of boosting regulatory capital in profitable years that followed unprofitable years. And so with the combination of these two impacts and looking at this year compared to prior years, we think some of these effects could be exacerbated. As a related development, the Federal Reserve just a few weeks ago, which I think in our current situation feels like 2 or 3 years ago, finalized a new rule that establishes what's called a stress capital buffer that is going to be an important component of the largest banking organization's regulatory capital requirements. So under that rule, the Federal Reserve is going to use the results of its supervisory stress test to determine the amount of the stress capital buffer, subject to a floor equal to 2.5% of risk-weighted assets, 2.5% of risk-weighted assets. And so the TCJA's elimination of NOL carrybacks and limitation on NOL carry forwards could cause for certain banks' projected Common Equity Tier 1 to decline more substantially under the stress test than it otherwise would, and that could lead to greater capital requirements via the stress capital buffer, and more likely that that buffer exceeds the 2.5% floor. Either of these would make it more likely that the results of each year's CCAR exercise, the supervisory stress tests, would act as the binding requirement that determines how much banks are actually are required to hold in the way of capital. So a lot of this depends on the specific bank's performance, existing regulatory capital requirements, but in these circumstances, with the looming effect of COVID-19 on financial performance, The elimination of NOL carrybacks and the stress capital buffer could have what we're calling an initial and pile-on effects for banks, insofar as there won't be any forthcoming relief from carrying back NOLs to prior years, resulting in an SCB or stress capital buffer that creates greater regulatory capital requirements. And that's all coming in a year in which capital ratios could be strained by the pandemic more broadly. And all of this is to say nothing about the vast array of financial recovery programs that the Federal Reserve has rolled out over the past week that could involve expansion of bank balance sheets in order to pump liquidity into the system. Those programs are quite numerous. We'd be happy to discuss them if people have questions, but too numerous to cover in the webinar today. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Ed McClellan for a discussion of some of the policy issues under the TCGA and also the COVID-19 legislation.
Okay, thank you, Michael, and good afternoon, everyone. We are on slide 12. As you can see on slide 12, we are well into a process of what's likely to be a series of COVID-related bills. We're focusing on the tax provisions today, with COVID-2 having tax credits for small businesses that provide emergency paid leave. I believe they settle on a 10-day or two-week leave period. COVID-3 is the one that is under current negotiation, and we anticipate that there will be a COVID-4 and possibly a COVID-5. There are rumors in Washington that COVID-4, dealing specifically with economic stimulus, could come up as early as May, but certainly not any earlier than May. Alternatively, we could see a COVID-4 bill that addresses only state and local issues, with a COVID-5 for economic stimulus coming in sometime after that, depending upon how long members are out of Washington. The House is out right now, and the Senate is anxious to leave town. With respect to COVID-3, there have been three bills in play on this. Let me just kind of walk you through this because it's relevant to the next chart. There was sort of what I would call the opening bid from Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell that was offered on Thursday night at about 5 p.m. in the evening. And that was the opening bid of the Republican view on what the framework should be for this COVID-3 bill. It included a variety of issues around appropriations for hospitals, but we'll focus only on the tax provisions. Those negotiations continued through the weekend until Sunday morning at 11 a.m., when Leader McConnell laid down another version of the bill, one that contained a series of concessions to Democrats that had occurred between Thursday night and Sunday morning. It was in part, I think, an attempt to force Democrats to make a decision on what they wanted. That bill was severely criticized by the Democrats, who claimed that they were still in the middle of negotiations and that it should not have been introduced, and that the Sunday morning bill is the one that went down yesterday. So they, with the Senate, will now procedurally have to restart the process. And a few minutes before this webinar began, Minority Leader Chuck Schumer of New York announced that they're making good progress on negotiations, that they're working hard, but nothing concrete came from that. In the middle of the proffer of the Sunday bill by Leader McConnell, Speaker Pelosi returned to town, I believe it was Sunday afternoon or at some point on Monday. Yesterday, she introduced a bill on behalf of House Republicans, or pardon me, House Democrats, which we will touch on lightly. And last night we saw a preliminary draft of what could be the next iteration of the yet another Senate bill, but it is not final, and so we cannot rely on it, as Senator Schumer suggested this morning. So we've got four moving pieces here, but let's go to slide 13 and walk through what is in the current bill and what was in the Thursday night bill, is in the Sunday bill, and hopefully will continue to be in the Senate bills. Slide 13, payroll tax deferral. This was in the original bill from Thursday night. the remaining 2020 employer share of payroll tax deductions would remissions of those the payroll employer share would be deferred in their payment dates, with half of the amounts that the employer owes would be remitted at the end of the 12/31/21 calendar year, and the other half would be remitted at the end of the 12/31/22 calendar year. So this would not cover the employee share, but it would cover the employer share. That was in the Thursday bill. It was included in the Sunday morning bill as well. It was expanded to include employers, predominantly smaller employers who received loan forgiveness in any small business program. They had been carved out of the original bill. They were put back in. And plus, there's a bit of immunity built into the bill for payroll agents and employer organizations so that they're not liable in the event that these amount that the employer fails to actually and ultimately remit the 2020 share with the two-year deferral. We believe, based on what we saw last night in the preliminary discussions, that that is still in the final package that we expect to come out hopefully this afternoon. It is not included in Speaker Pelosi's bill. There is no provision for this, and I'll come back to Speaker Pelosi's bill at the end of our discussion. There had also been in the original bill on Thursday night a provision that would have allowed all remaining 2020 corporate tax estimates to be delayed until October 15th of 2020. That was dropped in the Sunday morning bill, reflecting the negotiations with the Senate Democrats over the weekend. Similarly, there was a delay in filing deadline. The corporate returns would have been moved to the seventh month following the close of the taxable year. So for a calendar year taxpayer, the corporate return would have been pushed out to July 15th. Did not make it through the weekend negotiations. It was dropped in the Sunday morning bill. And so now notice 2020-18 is the only source of relief on filing delay. And, of course, none of these provisions are in the Pelosi bill. One of the more interesting provisions that has survived since Thursday night has been the NOL carryback and carryforward provisions, providing for a five-year carryback for taxable years ending in 2018, 2019, and 2020. There was an original glitch in the Thursday evening bill that would have permitted fiscal year taxpayers only a two-year carryback. That was fixed in the Sunday morning bill. There are still were and still remain some limitations on the carryback amounts, looking at 80% of the taxable income that is in excess of the 199 and 250 deductions. So do be cognizant of that. Right now, that we believe that the NOL carrybacks are still likely to be in the final Senate bill. There were fixes that were made on Sunday morning. As I mentioned, the fiscal year glitch was fixed. They also allowed insurance companies, life insurance companies specifically, to be eligible for this carryback. Their carrybacks had normally been allowed under a different code section. And then they specifically added a provision that the carryback is not applicable to any prior year 965 inclusions. Now, one thing that was noted, and our other panelists may note this later, is the delayed cash effectiveness for any NOL that occurs in 2020, which is the year in which most NOLs will be occurring. We've still got to get to the end of the taxable year, file the return, and then file for the refund claim. So there is going to be quite a delay in any cash infusions that may result from carrybacks from 2020. Nonetheless, all the latest indications are that it stays in the bill. The next item that has survived is Section 163J. And that is obviously a provision that lists the current 163J that Lindsay noted earlier, lists the 30% cap of adjusted taxable income to 50%. And in the Sunday morning version, it added some rather important opt-out language where corporations could decide not to take the 50% ATI, only to take the 30%. And the reason for that is because of the pro-cyclical effect, the pro-recessionary effect of the BEAT tax that Lindsay mentioned earlier. Many clients would end up paying a higher amount of tax under a higher 163J cap because of the BEAT tax. Some other companies would lose a considerable amount of tax credits that would be used for regular tax purposes and could not be used for BEAT purposes, and thus would have lost a valuable tax attribute. There was talk among the finance staff that perhaps the answer to that problem would have been a BEAT waiver under the 59A-3C6 proposed regulations, but as we all know, that waiver would have disallowed the deduction not only for 163J but for all purposes, so they wisely added some opt-out language along with some special partnership rules for 2019. It does appear that this provision also is still in the bill. Then there was the addition of some technical corrections to TCJA, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017. Of those, only a few have actually survived. One of the more important ones that has survived is qualified improvement property, which was intended to have a 15-year amortization period under 168E. It was in the original McConnell bill on Thursday night. It has survived negotiations over the weekend and is in the Sunday morning bill. It is retroactive back to the TCJA effective date, and it does appear to still be in the current set of negotiations. But again, let me warn everyone, we don't know where those negotiations stand, and the fear of everyone, of course, is that they somehow get kicked out to a COVID 4.0 to be taken up as part of economic stimulus. The idea of the COVID 3.0 is that it is an emergency bill. It is intended to bridge us through the end of May to give Congress additional time to consider other appropriate economic stimulus measures. So we're quite hopeful that everything that's in the bill now stays in the bill, because we expect the next round of negotiations to be even more contentious than the current round. As noted on the chart, the attempt to fix downward attribution, the 958B provision, was dropped over the weekend, along with the 965H provision that the IRS was using to block refunds of estimated tax overpayments. Both of those were dropped from the current set of negotiations, and we do not expect them to be added back in the final bill. There's also a minor provision, it's not on our chart, but a minor provision allowing the accelerated use of AMT credits. As you know, 53C TCJA repealed it, and it also eliminated many of the minimum tax carry forwards. This would allow refundable credits for both the 2018 and 2019 years and would permit some quickie refund procedures to be put into place, and we understand that that provision is also still in the negotiated bill. Now, let's touch just briefly on the Pelosi bill that was introduced yesterday on behalf of the House Democratic Caucus. It contains none of these provisions, all right? And what it does contain are a series of provisions on Affordable Care premium tax credits, expansion of the earned income tax credit, child tax credit, and the dependent care credit. Those are sort of the populist provisions that we would expect to see out of the House. They have no other corporate provisions. However, the Pelosi bill will likely never receive a vote. And at the end of the day, it is a statement of position of where the House Democratic Caucus is, but the real action remains in the negotiations between Leader Schumer and Leaders McConnell. And whatever they come out with is likely to be carried in the House. We still don't know whether the House will attempt to pass the bill by unanimous consent or whether they'll actually have to call the members back. But all indications are this morning is that they're not going to try to engage in remote voting in the House. So if they can't get everyone to agree with what comes out of the Senate, they'll have to bring the members back for a vote. Forward thinking into COVID 4.1, and then I'll wrap up here. Open questions, of course, is what will be in COVID 4.1. Will these dropped items come back in? The Democrats have rejected them once. Would they accept them in the context of an economic stimulus bill? And that is really to be determined because these represent some of the more daunting errors from TCJA. There are also other things that I think the business community needs to be thinking about, efforts to reverse the pro-cyclical effect of BEAT. There have been ideas put out there that in addition to not only delaying the due date of the next estimated tax payments, but should we be looking at lowering the estimated tax safe harbors from the 110% of last year's taxes to something considerably lower given the profitability uncertainty of this year. There are a whole potpourri of ideas developing out there. I'm sure that more will be bubbling up between now and May. But moving to slide 14, I think that we should also acknowledge that there are perhaps a number of things that Treasury will be able to do. If we cannot get a legislative response, Treasury has already taken up, as I noticed, stated about their notice to delay the tax payment filing deadlines. They are addressing coverage costs under high deductible plans. And Michael Caballero also has another set of ideas that he is going to discuss now on measures that were taken back in 2008 that might be transferable to the current scenario. Michael?
Hey, Ed, before we get to Michael, I'm not going to let you off the hook. Among the provisions that are being discussed for, COVID 3.0 or 4.0, a question arose as to whether a carryback for capital losses for individuals might be on the table. I've not heard anything about that. Have you?
There was talk of that early on, actually. There was a lot of talk about that, and there was talk about doing that unilaterally through the administration, which really drew the ire of Congress because they feel that's within their wheelhouse. Yes, I do think that that's something that will come up in COVID 4.0. It has been circulating within the administration. They've talked about it, but it's probably going to take legislative action.
Got it. And then another question for you and Mike. I know there's been a lot of talk of NOLs, and that seems to be a provision that is making its way through and surviving all these cuts. Do the folks on the Hill understand the impacts that Mike discussed on bank liquidity, or are they focused, solely on large corporations and company liquidity?
Based on the conversations I've had, it's predominantly company liquidity. I've not heard anyone raise concern about banking liquidity anywhere up and down the line. They're also operating under extraordinary stress right now, and their ability to consider the broader implications is actually quite limited given the time frame and the contentiousness of the negotiations. So that's certainly something that should be highlighted, I think, as things calm down a bit. It is going to be very difficult to build the next bill because everyone's going home. Right now there are a number of critical staff that are still on the Hill. It remains to be seen whether they're going to be there or be working from home. So I think just getting that message out is going to be even more complicated for the next round because certainly the members will be gone.
Got it. So, Mike, it sounds like you have a challenge to educate Congress on the issues that you went through as well.
Yeah, I think that's right, Dan.
And then I have a question. I think for Lindsay, I'm going to read it verbatim because I don't want to screw it up. So the question is the takeaway from the suspension of Section 956, et cetera, that regardless of the complication of the PTEP rules, you can lend and re-lend for as long as needed to get the use of the money in the U.S., subject, of course, to having to pay a reasonable rate. So,
yes.
Lindsay, do you have some thoughts on that?
Yeah. So, I mean, the gist is, in some ways, lending is easier, but you still need to take into account your particular facts. So the earnings that you're lending either need to be covered by PTEP or eligible for 245 CAFE. That means they can't be subject to the ED and ER rules in -5T, and you have to meet the holding period requirements. And if those meet them, if those requirements are met, then the 956 loan will generally not result in an inclusion. But you also need to think about the effects of the interest expense on your profile, because additional interest expense to a foreign related party could have BEAT implications. It could have 153J implications. So while it is a tool, you just need to consider how it'll affect the whole system before you do it.
Michael, I think Ed was transitioning to you, so I have no further interruptions. So why don't we do that transition?
Okay, thank you very much. And this is picking back up on the slide about regulatory responses, slide 14. I guess the biggest thing I'd say, as Ed has already demonstrated, there is a lot going on the legislative front. And I think it's particularly interesting for many of us who lived through the 2008 financial crisis to sort of reflect back on that and the place we're at today. The amount of legislative activity, the magnitude of legislative activity, and the speed of legislative activity, as best I can tell, is dramatically more significant than what happened in 2008. I note that because it's good news. Congress is moving very quickly, and it also means there may be opportunities for taxpayers to the extent they have good ideas that fit into this process, to help everyone in this process. Regulatory responses are another important part of this. As Ed was mentioning, there's already some things that have taken place where Treasury has already delayed some deadlines and things that have a first step. You look back to 2008, there were a number of measures that were taken back then to deal with the crisis, some loosening of the 956 rules, there were loosening of REIT rules, changes around 382. Of course, what we're dealing with is a different crisis, and maybe more importantly than that, sometimes we have a totally different tax law. And so the history of some of those responses may not necessarily mean they will translate neatly into the new system, but that doesn't take away the fact that a lot of the goals that were attempted to be accomplished with that still remain equally important. 956 obviously has very limited impact under the current TCJA rules. And so the kind of relief that was provided in 2008 may no longer make any sense at all. But the underlying policy, the ability of companies to access offshore cash to deal with their current cash position, is going to become really important. And therefore, similar rules that alleviate repatriation concerns are going to become, I think, important. And if the legislative activity is any indication of the government's willingness to come up with solutions to the crisis, presumably we will see a similar degree of interest and appetite in the regulatory front for solutions that help alleviate the crisis, governed, of course, by there will be limits that what can be done as an administrative matter and not through a statutory change. The hard part about this is I think a lot of it's going to be very specific, as we've all come to learn over the past 2 years. Everything about TCJA is complicated and often very idiosyncratic to each individual company's situation or particular industries. And so I think it is the kind of thing industries and taxpayers need to be focused on. Are there regulatory responses that might be viable that could be presented to the Treasury Department to take some of the pressure off the current system? Obviously, particular industries like aviation, financial services, or places where industry-specific rules can make some sense, the ability to lay effective dates for regulations that are already in the pipeline are things to consider, and not to jump too far ahead to some of the things. We don't have a lot of PTEP guidance, for example, but there are PTEP regs that are in process. It's something everybody should be thinking about, that Treasury is still open for business. They're still trying to move guidance, and that guidance may also come out and change around the way the rules that we're operating under today take place. Sensitizing the government to the needs that a lot's going on this year and whether or not anything that comes out needs to only be prospective, things like that, I think are going to also be important parts of the communicating the needs of industry to the government. With that, I was going to flip to just some high-level thoughts on planning responses that we're already seeing, and I think everyone is going to be doing increasing levels of focus over the next 6 to 9 months. The first good news is I think many of the planning responses that companies need to be taking mirror the same planning approaches that taxpayers were either in the process of implementing to adjust to TCJA or at least starting to think about how to change the way their tax departments operate to work with the new law. Some of that is practical stuff. Developing information reporting, a lot of the new provisions and rules create unexpected margins. And so how losses hit in the system has become really important, as Lindsay pointed out before. And it's not just losses, but losses in the U.S., losses abroad, losses in individual entities now matter. And so developing information, gathering procedures to identify where losses are happening are important. Developing procedures to assess where one's status is under BEAT, under the 3% threshold, and things like that are all real-time processes that need to be brought online. Part of that's because if you're going to make changes, you're going to want to make them before you get to the end of the year. And so the ability to assess one's position mid-year, whether it's in the fall or late fall, early winter, and take any kind of curative measures is going to be incredibly important. Part of taking curative measures is starting to identify different tools that can be used at the end of the year to try and ameliorate some of the sort of kinks in the system. As we'll discuss and has been discussed a little bit, the annual accounting period has become incredibly important for different things, especially GILTI. What are the practical ways taxpayers can kind of manage around the annual accounting period to sort of self-help their way into a multi-year tax result? This has been out there for the last couple of years. We've been dealing with it, but of course, the losses that people are likely to see, at least in some industries, in 2020 mean that all that process is going to have to happen on a very accelerated basis. Other things, reassessing tax position, there's a lot moving, as Ed has already talked about. There's more likely to come. Some of these things aren't tax rules, but nonetheless, things that impact the business are obviously going to impact tax results. NOL rules will be important, very helpful if they go forward and people have access to an immediate refund or at least a refund sometime early next year. Of course, there are some interesting conundrums that these rules are going to present. For example, as already discussed, if you end up running losses in the current year, you have some negative impact. You can affect your GILTI foreign tax credits. If you have an overall GILTI loss, you may not be able to take advantage of it and things like that. So a current year loss actually can affect your current year tax attributes in a way that is not recoverable. At the same time, in order to have getting ahead of it a little bit, you can obviously ameliorate that if there are ways to accelerate income, decelerate deductions and things like that. Of course, anything that you do to ameliorate losses in the current year may mean that the ability to take advantage of the net operating loss provisions, assuming they go forward, and the ability to get a carryback refund could also diminish. And so you could literally find yourself at some point in the middle of this year of trying to make a decision, do I need the refund, and am I willing to live with the tax cost of that refund with the impact that it has with respect to other tax attributes that are going on in 2020. The last thing I'd say about all this is, of course, this is a very dynamic situation. This crisis theoretically could be significantly resolved at any moment due to scientific advancements, vaccines, other treatments, and things like that. So it's very predictable to understand what's going to happen over the remaining 9 months of 2020. Difficult to predict profitability, especially as I've seen taxpayers who have segments of their business that are doing extremely well in a strange way, in that they're just effectively cannot produce fast enough in particular types of equipment, medical equipment, and things like that. And even in the same company, other portions of the business, even other portions of the healthcare business and things like that, that may be negatively impacted as other types of medical procedures are diminishing. So there's a wide variety of things going on and trying to figure out where that's all going to end up. The last thing I'd say, and we have an appendix at the end that's just a summary, all the action that we're seeing in the U.S. on Congress and potentially from the administration is going to be replicated of some kind in a lot of places around the world. And so one is going to need to be tracking those developments to see what those impacts are having on your international operations and how that factors into everything that you're trying to do from a U.S. tax perspective. Just jumping to the next slide, acceleration of income and deceleration of deductions or losses. As already mentioned, you know, the importance of the annual accounting period cannot be stressed. This situation turns out, I think, put the most pressure on it in that we could have very significant losses in 2020 that at least to some extent are offset by positive gains in 2021, depending on how this entire crisis times. You know, you think about certain industries like the automotive industry. 2008, 2009, nobody needed to buy a car, so nobody did. When things ultimately turned around, lots of people bought cars, and the bounce back in the industry was quite pronounced. You could imagine that the deceleration of the economy is quicker in the current cycle or the current crisis, and hopefully the rebound is much quicker than it was coming out of 2008, but it could very well mean that you could have a very significant sort of whipsaw between 2020 and 2021. The rules don't deal very well when there's a small whipsaw between those two periods, and we could see a very big one. So when you think about that, what do you need to do to preserve current year attributes? GILTI is probably the worst case of this annual accounting period phenomenon where foreign tax credits could disappear, the tax rate could go up. If you have an overall loss in the U.S., if you have an overall loss abroad, that won't be usable either in the future year. So something to be thinking about, depending where you're at, is are there ways to mitigate that? And at least from a tax department perspective, there may be the ability to accelerate income, decelerate losses, things that people need to be thinking about doing. And, of course, thinking about that means putting into place, to the extent they don't exist, the kind of monitoring, information gathering to assess where those losses are showing up and to begin to identify practical solutions to accelerate income or decelerate deductions, which is unfortunately going to be very idiosyncratic to each company and industry and kind of profit center within your company. Another important thing to note is location of losses has really mattered. Will matter. I'm jumping to the next slide. Even at the highest level, the value of a loss depends on the tax rate. We're taxed at 21% in the U.S., a branch operation, subpart F, 10.5% on GILTI. So where losses end up between those different categories can have a very significant effect. As Lindsay already discussed, the U.S. losses can have significant negative effects on GILTI and FDII, and the tax rate benefits that those two items of income affect. Offshore losses aren't necessarily a solution either. They can produce their own problems. So losses have become a huge issue, and most strangely in some ways, where those losses are at, whether in the U.S. or abroad, if abroad, in which CFC, in the U.S., if it's in a branch, or if it's really in the U.S. operations, all these things mean that the location of losses has meant more than it ever has. I would add to that a big thing that could cut across all this, but it's too detailed to get into, is FX gains and losses, I think, are going to become a very big issue over the next year or two. And, of course, a lot of that may depend on how the U.S. performs vis-a-vis other countries economically. It's hard to imagine, while everyone is going to get hit, the idea that everyone's going to be hit equally seems really unlikely. Moving forward to the next slide, what does location of losses mean? Planning responses. Again, while you cannot control business results, thinking about opportunities to spread income may become really important. And by that, it's really trying to make sure if overall the company is at one position, that you don't have pockets within your group that are effectively offsetting one another. To have one entity lose money, for example, a CFC lose money, while another CFC is making money, can produce some negative results that may not make a lot of sense, since TCJ in some ways consolidated your foreign operations under GILTI, but its treatment of tested loss companies means that you can lose attributes in those companies, individual CFCs that lose money. So looking at intercompany items, are there ways to avoid creating losses in one CFC and income in another that are attributable to intercompany items that can be addressed? Debt is obviously the easiest. Things get harder, though, when you start talking about intercompany royalties and management fees, where you're dealing with actual value transfers between CFCs for the right to use intellectual property or other services and things like that. But those payments are intercompany payments that at least are within the power of the company to manage on a going forward basis. Transfer pricing, another deep topic that we're not going to get into, but transfer pricing approaches at one level can be shifting money between the U.S. and abroad and between different members of the group. It's something that people should be thinking about. And, of course, this is already a place where I think there's going to be a lot of thought that's going to be required, because a lot of the underlying assumptions that support transfer pricing methodologies have been sort of flipped on their heads. The idea of a limited risk distributor is an interesting concept in that kind of economic environment we're seeing, and that's only one of many, many things in the transfer pricing space. It does mean it's something to think about if you're already required to sort of dig into transfer pricing. How do you also think about these issues about spreading of income among the group? The last thing I'd say, just jumping to a slide on repatriation planning, if the last crisis was any indication, and I think we're already starting to see it, cash is going to be extremely important. Accessing cash from your foreign operations is a very good source. Post-TCJ, of course, repatriation has become much more complicated than anybody thought. There are a number of idiosyncratic problems to PTEP, complicated by the fact that PTEP is now in every subsidiary you have around the world. 5 years ago, everybody had small amounts of PTI, and they knew exactly where it was at in a limited number of entities. Now every subsidiary on the chart basically has some amount of PTEP, and how do you access it? And importantly about that, a lot of that PTEP is in jurisdictions without income tax treaties. Why that matters a lot is because, of course, minimizing or eliminating local withholding taxes when you bring money home is extremely important. Withholding taxes are effectively complete dead weight if you're in excess credit position and guilty, or quite frankly, if you have U.S. losses or other reasons why you're not going to be able to use foreign tax credits, withholding taxes are just complete tax friction on bringing money home. How do you address it? As Lindsay already said, and I think we're going to see increasing amounts, lending back to the U.S. Is one very real tool. The existence of PTEP solves a lot of the 956 issues, but obviously the government has stepped in, and if you have earnings that qualify for 245, turn off 956 to that extent as well. There are a lot of pitfalls in making sure 956 loans don't create problems and dealing with BEAT, but it's a very significant opportunity to access offshore cash, and it may have some other related benefits when doing your expense allocation computation, which are complicated but nonetheless important, as many people have come to learn expense allocation has only become significantly more important under TCJA. The last couple of things to think about are whether there are more complicated ways to get money home through transactions, liquidations, or other types of transactions. my experience has been a lot of companies have not done the kind of complete restructuring of their global operations and how they hold those operations. But a lot of them are starting to think about entity simplification, and that involves some of these more extraordinary transactions. I think it's something everybody will be doing over the course of this year, trying to take advantage of the work that's already been done and moving towards a simpler system, and some of those moves also being dovetailing with this goal of ways to get cash home, both in a tax-efficient way for U.S. purposes and tax-efficiently for foreign tax purposes. And, you know, one thing I threw on the bottom there is 304 transactions, which used to be a staple in the world of repatriation. I haven't seen a 304 in the last couple of years, truthfully. A lot of that were concerns around 1059. The government has made some indications that that the 1059 problem may not exist. And so maybe 304s will be another thing for people to start thinking about, but all in this broader sense of what are tax-efficient ways to be bringing money home to the U.S. And with that, I think
hey, Michael, in the last couple of minutes, let me reiterate a point and then ask a couple of questions. The point about the transfer pricing adjustments on, you know, our global organizations where you have limited risk distributors or entrepreneurs or, you know, principals, blah, 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 all of that is based on, you know, all of those models are based on assumptions of a band of profitability. And to the extent we fall out of it, we're going to have to be revisiting those arrangements. We're going to have to be making end-of-year adjustments. And that, to me, really puts on the table the question of whether these entities that in normal times would be guaranteed a level of profit, whether that makes sense in times where the whole organization is, in fact, suffering, or whether, you know, whether competitors, distributors or sales companies may be suffering. So all of that, I think, is really on the table for the last half of this year in terms of trying to figure out how those arrangements need to be changed and modified in light of the big changes. A question for you and Ed, and you know, we have about 1 minute left, a question for you and Ed on Treasury's willingness to act on its own. I mean, in my little world, I'm already aware that folks are going back and asking the administration for the same types of relief that they asked for in 2008. So, you know, redistribution relief or like-kind exchange relief, and in how long of a period you get to purchase replacement property, for example. I assume that we believe the administration will be sensitive to those requests now, and that companies really should be focused both on the legislation and on administrative relief.
I think. Go ahead, Michael. Go ahead.
So, well, I was just going to say, it's early days, but I take the couple changes we've already seen to be a positive indication. And even when you flip back to 2008, the Treasury took a number of extraordinary measures, some of which, you know, resulted in Inspector General investigations of whether the guidance was appropriate, but it did demonstrate an administration who presumably wasn't any more forward-leaning around the kinds of things that the government should be doing, found itself forced to make very significant moves. And again, the need, I think, will drive all this, and we don't even know what the need will be, you know, a month, 2 months from now, and what that'll do for Treasury and how they think about approaches to this. I don't know if you'd add to that, Ed, or your comments.
Can I just say something real quick?
Yeah.
Sorry. I just want to say, like, in my conversations with some people, I think the one thing to keep in mind is that we just want to make sure that if you're going to Treasury with something, that you can articulate sort of what the problem the solution is solving for and how it relates to the current situation, because I do think they are going to be very sensitive to whether people are asking for things that are, you know, actually legitimately helpful given the current circumstances, or things that are just more would like to have that people might have come in about before.
Yeah, Lindsay is exactly right about that. I've noticed that there are a lot of proposals coming from, including some of the big and sophisticated trade associations in Washington, stating that, you know, the problem to be addressed here are actually things that they've been asking for 3 or 4 years. Some of the things don't even take effect for a couple of more years on out into 2020. And when I speak with staff, the focus is all about short-term cash liquidity and minimizing the take out of the cash flows. That seems to be the primary focus. I don't know if that answers your question or not, Dan, but that's what I'm saying.
Fantastic. And then as we wrap up, one more question for you, Ed. This goes back to the capital loss question a moment ago, I guess 30 minutes ago now. Are there also thoughts about expanding the limitation, increasing the limitation from 3,000 on capital losses?
Well, earlier the administration had been focused on capital gains, and I should have been a little more specific. They were looking to actually adjust an exemption for capital gains according to account for inflation, right? That was their thing, that they were wanting to effectively lower the capital gains rate because the market was going up, and they wanted to adjust it, index it for inflation, and to do that internally. The situation has obviously changed. And I do think that this would be a prime opportunity to advance a higher capital loss limitation. Maybe something in the 10,000 range is not beyond reason. It may meet some resistance from Democratic corners and the more popular corners, but there will be a lot of people quite negatively affected by this. Even by the end of this taxable year, I don't think we'll reclaim the 38% market loss, I think was the last number that I saw. So I would say yes, that is something that should become part of a short-term COVID 4.0, even if it's only for a few years. Once you have it established, you know, you'll just have to come back to get it extended permanently. But I think that's certainly got to be in the mix.
Fantastic. Ed, you get the last word. We appreciate very much all of your attention to our webinar this afternoon. We hope that it has been helpful and enlightening, and obviously we're happy to follow up on an individual basis with any questions you might have. So with that, I will turn it back over to the operator and to Al, and again, thank you very much for tuning in.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.